the opening of the puja that we do is these chants of taking refuge in Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. And as I said in the beginning of the meditation, one of the ways we can think about this is that we take refuge in the forces or aspects of the life that we've found in the world that feel like they are more reliable than the default that we might find ourselves in. So to take refuge, you know, the early metaphors are things like, you know, you're in a great storm and you take refuge in under shelter, or you're being tossed around by a raging river and you take refuge on an island. You gain a kind of footing or security there. So there's the taking refuge itself, like what you go for refuge to, and if you take these refuges in a traditional Buddhist sense, they're refuge in the person of the enlightened teacher, the Buddha, the basket or collection of teachings, guidelines that this tradition has preserved, and then the community of practitioners, especially the community of practitioners with some experience and wisdom and maturity who can support you and guide you. That's a very traditional approach to what we take refuge to. Tonight I want to talk a bit about what we take refuge from to start off the year. The State of the Union address is looming on the horizon. One might feel the need to take refuge sometime soon. And these metaphors of, like, you're tossed in a raging river, you know, or I'm out in a storm without shelter. It might seem kind of obvious that, like, oh, the world is super chaotic and things are messy, they're harmful, they're dangerous, all that is true. Very often, and really I think in every culture, there are some things that we're taught early on to take refuge in. And, you know, some of them we might see very clearly as being a kind of unwholesome or, you know, not really good for us. Like, you know, as a California suburban teenager, I was taught to take refuge in, you know, sitcoms, say, like television, entertainment of a certain kind, which has its value, but ultimately, you know, didn't ever prove to be much of a secure refuge. In other words, the hard stuff in my life stayed hard no matter how many sitcoms I watched. And I tried. Right? Like without knowing it, you know, I did this teenager thing. I was like, things are better when I'm watching TV. I wouldn't have even been able to say it, but it was true. Right? Why would I have done it so much if that wasn't true? It was a state called numb. But that's better than the state called pain. Yeah. So in a way, you know, I had this, like, oh, here's this thing I take refuge in. And then it turns out to be not a very good refuge. Doesn't help much. Even starts to hurt after a while. And I took refuge in other things. I took refuge in things that my culture taught me were more wholesome. I took refuge in classical music for a while. And meaning, you know, I had this sense of, if I just kept practicing and kept playing and kept being immersed in this one culture, again, the perception was something like this wider culture, like the dangerous or not, you know, wholesome aspects of American culture wouldn't really get me. Like, for a while, I had this weird ideal that I was going to get a kind of job where I sort of had a patron, and I got to kind of wear old-fashioned suits and just sit at the piano and write music by hand every single day, right? In other words, I essentially wanted to be, you know, Chopin, to choose a nice, you know, effeminate, brilliant pianist, who was kind of my model at the time. effeminate, brilliant pianists. I managed the first, didn't quite manage the second. Worked on the third for a long time. But classical music didn't save me from pain. Like, it turned out to be full of, you know, neurotic people, like everything else. And the art form itself even began to crumble under my gaze. I learned so much about it that bit by bit, it just lost all mystery and power. And the place that it really ended for me was when I actually realized that it had very little cultural power anymore, that it wasn't actually going to save me from my culture. And so, and this happened again and again, you know, to so many things. And of course it happens when we, you know, we hook up with a teacher and they turn out to be flawed. My first Buddhist teacher was an old Zen teacher who was a strangely brilliant mystic who had something to say about the nature of the oscillation between zero and one that I completely did not understand at the age of 24 when I was living in his monastery. The thing I came to understand as I stayed there for retreat after retreat was that although his Dharma was mystical and subtle, the way that he abused every woman who came into the room with him was not. And that was partly why I left that community, you know, disillusioned in part. So refuge suggests that it's actually dangerous, but at the very least ineffective, to take refuge in the wrong things. And so what it points to is that so much in this life we find ourselves in is, in a certain way, and I want to say this in a sensitive way, the wrong things to take refuge in. And what this means in a Buddhist context is not that there are not wholesome things in the world, because there totally are. And it doesn't mean there aren't good people and good things to do that can shelter you from pain and distress, because of course there are. What it means in a very traditional Buddhist context is that even those things are themselves impermanent and therefore ultimately unreliable. So like after, you know, years and years of searching for some kind of place I could call home and land and feel secure with, I attained something that lots of folks covet and really put a lot of belief in being a great refuge, which is I met someone and fell in love and then got married. And I'm still married after like 10-some years. Check it out. Not what I ever thought was going to happen, but it happened. And so then here's this thing. It's wholesome, right? It's a good relationship. It's hard in a good way. It's good in a hard way. You know, whatever. It's challenging, as relationships are. But it's wonderful. What it's not, however, and again, in this very traditional way, is what it's not and can't be is an ultimate refuge. When I was first together with my sweetheart, and we were sort of contending with that like, oh my God, maybe this is like really where I want to be. It was like with you. She did this thing for a little while where she would kind of grab my shoulders and shake me and say, don't ever die. And the first time she said it, I wanted to give a sort of wise Buddhist answer. I was like, no, shut up. I was like, okay. Totally. I'll do my damnedest to not die. And And so poignant because, you know, we all know what's true, or sort of. We know it in a kind of sequestered part of the heart that we don't have a conversation with very often until it happens. Close enough that we can feel the shockwaves coming out from it. But there's this reminder that's threaded through all of these teachings that, you know, you got a body. It ages, it's going to get sick, it's going to die. That's going to happen to everyone you know. That reminder that we chant. And often when we chant it, I'm like, do we really need to do this every time? But every time I'm like, I think it kind of just needs to be said over and over. And very few places in this culture actually will say it. You know, those five recollections. I'm of the nature to age and sicken and die and lose that which is mine. And the only thing that I own is my actions. And this is some of the most ancient solid wisdom from this tradition. And it's cold comfort sometimes. Yeah. Because like I've got this lovely marriage and it's not reliable. You know, not through anyone's fault. Actually, if it were, it wouldn't be possible to get liberated. If anything were a refuge that was permanent, meaning forever, that's the kind of philosophical context of this conversation, is a search for that which could be a home forever, not just a temporary one within this lifetime. A home for the energy that my actions move. That it can't actually be the things that fluctuate. And so interwoven with refuge as a practice or discipline of turning my gaze and my reliance toward these things that are more reliable, that could bring me to liberation, is also a recognition of that I'm turning toward them because, which is change and dissatisfaction and loss. That loss is so reliable. Loss is reliable. Haha. But because of that, I either need to get liberated in relation to it, like no longer be troubled by the reality of being in the ecosystem. Really, that's the only option, actually. Haha. Or I can keep distracting myself. Those are the two. In a very traditional sense. And so refuge becomes what can I do to heal the ache in myself or the traditional word would be ignorance, avidya, not knowing or incorrect perception, where I take things to be a possible refuge that can't be a refuge, right? I turn toward a relationship or a certain kind of entertainment or a certain ideology. There have totally been times when I've taken refuge in, you know, being a radical leftist and being like, the world's chaotic, but at least I know what's right, economically and politically. You know, they won't ever do it, which of course makes it even easier to be right because it'll never get tested. My utopian, you know, communist, but do it better than the old communists did it. Right, ideal. I took refuge in that, and of course, if you take refuge in anything like a political system, you will see it fail every time it gets tried, more or less. So it also can't be a refuge. That doesn't mean I don't still think it's a better way to do things. But this becomes then both a wisdom practice of seeing constantly. This is the meditation. Just see how everything changes. Every moment, here's this thought, here's this feeling. Here's this new idea, it changes, it changes, it changes. That's the practice, is to observe that. And then the discipline of what to do with that is like, okay, how do I turn toward that which will guide me to well-being in relation to this that is now more and more I'm seeing is clearly true? And so Refuge says, seeing the truth of change and suffering, I turn toward the path, basically. Refuge also means I believe in liberation. I believe my teachers, I believe the senior students in lineages that I've been drawn to, that some amount of liberation or clarity is possible. No worries, but it's beautiful.
Whenever you say liberation, Sean.
Liberation. angelic chimes appear. I didn't know I was so close.
Awesome.
Totally, totally.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Nice effect.
Yeah, totally. If you're feeling it too, you can add, you know.
If you can't hear that chime, don't worry.
Yeah. Yeah. So one of my teachers, Robert, was really skeptical about teachers with supernatural powers back in the 70s. He met this guy, Adi Da, who was at the time calling himself Bubba Freejohn, but turned into Adi Da eventually. He said he was totally skeptical. People were doing the full guru, like bowing, prostrating, adoring him, praying to his picture. And my teacher, Robert, who was a clinical psychologist and just fierce, he was just like, yeah, whatever, right? But his friends took him. He was like, fine, I'm going to go see this guy. He's kind of famous, funny, you know, like fat New Yorker in pink robes, way up on the stage up there, thousands of people. And he was like, okay, whatever. So he's sitting in the back. He's just like, and all this stuff is going on. And he says, okay, you know. Yes, totally. Can you hear the birds?
Say no more.
Say no more. And he says, okay, I'm here. You know, I've got an hour to spend with this guy. Like, whatever. I'm gonna see if it's true. And so he's like, I'm just gonna try it. Like through all the sky. I totally don't believe, but I'm gonna do it. He visualized Adi Da's face. He started saying his name, and he just applied his concentration. He's a strong practitioner. He closed his eyes, and he was just doing this for a little bit, kind of saying the mantra that they were telling people to say. And he heard a sound, and he opened his eyes. I'm telling you this verbatim from his story. He says he opened his eyes, and Adi Da was, like, right in front of him, just, like, leaning on the chair in front of him, way at the back of the auditorium, right, gazillions of people, just laughing hysterically. And he looks up at him. Adi Da is just right there in front of him. You know, just like a, just standing there laughing. Robert goes like, whoa. Closes his eyes, opens his eyes. Adi Da's gone. He's still up there on the stage. What are you going to do? He didn't end up becoming a follower of Adi Da. So he was like, okay, it works. Right? Skepticism, check. You know. Doesn't mean you need to follow the guy around. So if you can hear the magic bells, you know, my mailing list is over there. No, this past month, an energetically powerful but probably profoundly something scary guru got taken down in Sedona. So I've been tracking a little bit, sort of, you know, guru. Guru's crashing. Guru's crashing. It's pastime. So just to finish up, that was the humorous commercial. People with supernatural powers. So I want to chat together a little bit about really this basic dynamic then of this weave between how I recognize the difficulty of the world, or the challenges, the pains, the distress, the suffering that I'm undergoing. and that I recognize in some way how some amount of that distress is built on this mistaken orientation that I have, that I look toward things that can't be secure, as if they're secure. Right? The traditional verse says the sort of definition of delusion is that I take that which is not beautiful to be beautiful, not permanent to be permanent, not reliably satisfying to be satisfying. And so, you know, I get hypnotized in a way by kind of momentary sensory eruptions, you know. And I don't see more deeply into the whole thing. So this is the wisdom seeing, the wisdom practice, seeing this clearly. And then the refuge piece that folds out of that is, having seen that, there's a question that joins them. The question is, what can I do in relation to that? Like, what do you do once you realize that you've just been looking for things that even if you got them, are not going to be the thing you were actually looking for, which is security or stability, certainty, safety? So then the question, what can I do? And then the answer, at least from within, you know, the kind of the practice tradition, is you can practice toward liberation. And liberation simply meaning that through seeing those things clearly with wisdom, the question no longer arises. You know how to relate to things as they change, right? Not by expecting them to be otherwise. And it turns out that when the heart makes that shift, something that's profound and deeply, a deep taproot into who we actually are. Like this thing of grasping at things erroneously, it's not just a kind of surface distraction thing that we do. It's actually the nature of our identity. That's who we think we are, is that. If you take away that thing, the whole structure changes, because that's what it's built on. And so, what do I do? Here's a path that can lead to liberation and change the whole thing. So then refuge becomes a commitment to your path. And so this is partly why we chant it then, each time we meet. So take a moment then, we'll talk together. Take a moment, and this first piece of recognizing that we go for refuge, we habitually go for refuge to things that are not reliable as a refuge. And just see if you notice, like, what that might be for you. It comes in so many forms. What are those things? It's another way of saying what we grasp at. But in this particular way, how I might think that this thing is going to be a home for me. When even if it is, the home is temporary, and it's never exactly what I think it was going to be. Just sense into it for a moment for yourself. Well, let's just hear from a couple of folks. Any reflections on that, or anything you notice in looking at that aspect of what your heart-mind does. Yeah.
Well, a couple of obvious things came up for me first, like, I don't know, lovers and nature.
Yeah.
And I really started thinking about, like, what's more consistent, or what's there for me, or what I call home, or what I take refuge in, is really my friendships. Mm-hmm. And the friendships that have stuck with me or stood by me. And I noticed that although
Yeah.
And all the things that I need.
Yeah.
And that there is a constant state of like planning my week around that thing that I'm doing with that friend on Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of like always week after week unfolds. And I never quite get the like what I'm looking for in that.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I get bits of it. It's not like it's
right. 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 This is, I think this is important. Like, part of what I hear you pointing to is that there's this whole spectrum, right? Like, there's taking refuge in those friendships is, it does give you more reliability or certainty than, say, you know, lovers who may come and go over the years, you know, or other things that aren't as continuous in our lives. I think that's true for a lot of us. But yeah, they can't give that full certainty. Like, you're not marrying them, unless you are, but if you're not, you know, whatever that, and whatever marry means, you know, and who even knows. But even if, you know, even if you did, then there's the existential fluctuations, right? Someone dies, and, but that doesn't mean that the, you know, what they give you isn't tremendously, maybe some of the most valuable, right? And this is true around like the religious refuges as well, like Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. These things are themselves impermanent and unreliable. Yeah? A Sangha, a community of committed practitioners to support you on the path, this is something that I know a lot of folks really want, and it's hard to come by, right? Maybe you get a lot of solace out of coming here, you know, each week, those of you who are regulars here, and this is, becomes important to you. At any moment, you know, like, this group could dissolve. The studio could close. I could have to move away. Somebody could die. Like, this whole thing is impermanent. Like, there's no way we can sustain it. Yeah? And even the things that sustain through tremendous organization, like the Buddhist monastic order, thus the, quote, formal Sangha, has sustained more or less unbroken for 2,500 years. That doesn't mean it's permanent. And the Buddha talks all over the texts about what will happen when the Dhamma disappears from the world. Right? There's all these conditions, some of which are present in the culture right now, that are causes for true practice to disappear from the world. You know? And so it's not like it's reliable either. When the Buddha got enlightened, he said, it was as if I was in a pathless jungle and I came upon an ancient overgrown path. And clearing it by my own efforts, I found my way to an ancient city, no longer inhabited, a tremendous palace in the woods, overgrown from centuries past. In other words, you know, the truth that these teachings point to has a kind of eternalness, which is to say it's just a description of the ecosystem, so it's a natural law. That's a translation of the word dharma. But that doesn't mean it's always going to be available. And you could totally, you know, not have this whole body of work available to you very easily, actually. So even the great refuges are not themselves final refuges. Only liberation can be a final refuge in this tradition. Other reflections as you feel into like these things that we take as refuges that can't be. Yeah, Caitlin.
So as you were just talking about, you know, even the teachings themselves being, you know, not these, like, completely reliable refuges, and then liberation being the only reliable refuge, I feel like all that is familiar to me are refuges that are not that ultimately are not reliable.
Yeah.
And so the idea of like ultimate liberation is often just feels so, you know, like looking at a star.
Yeah.
Like I can kind of intellectually like take in and but really like I feel as though my body has no idea what that would even like. It seems so alien to me because my whole existence is, you know, it's like it when you talk about you know, like I know that relationships ultimately are not like my permanent home, or you know, my identity is not my permanent home, or my job or whatever, like my family, even, you know, like my body, like that. I can feel that, but I can't feel like not, I can't feel what liberation would be.
Totally.
So
totally.
How do you like, or maybe you don't have all the answers, but
I don't.
But like, well,
but if,
like,
but if you can hear the angelic chimes.
Yeah, I felt it in that moment. It's like, oh.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, you know what I'm trying to
totally.
Say.
Yeah, you know. Buddhism doesn't have a lot of things in it that are points of faith that you have to like believe in, right? Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean that the quality of belief isn't part of it, because there's a whole period between becoming devoted to kind of these teachings or this orientation as guidelines, and feeling the certainty in yourself that they're correct and that you're on the path and that liberation is inevitable. The period between that first inspiration and the feeling of inevitability contains throughout it the possibility that doubt will derail you. Right? And this is true with any tradition, right? Anything that you get into. In between inspiration and like, you know, buying the farm is all sorts of pitfalls of doubt. And in this system, buying the farm means stream entry. It means you get an insight, a body of insights into the truth of this understanding. And you see through the veil for a moment. And you still have a long way to go before it's all done. But you've seen it clearly enough that final liberation is assured. Traditionally, that is to say, within 7 lifetimes. Which is supposed to be a really awesome promise to you, right? Because compared to gazillions, 7 is really doable. Yeah. You know? So in relation to knowing what liberation feels like, this is important, and you don't need to attain some mystical pre-modern, you know, assessment called stream entry to know it. I talk about it mostly, and you've heard me talk about it this before, as a very deep kind of developmental maturing. And so if we're going to talk lovers, here's the exercise for that, which is think of your first crush, however far back you have to go. For me, it's like junior high-ish, probably. Your first sort of crush that wasn't sort of like a little kid crush, but it was actually like, I want to kiss that person, or whatever it was. You know, think about them, whether you got together or not. And see if you still have, if you can still feel that charge that we call crush, the thing that you actually kind of believed in that moment, which was that some kind of contact with this being would be the thing to get. How would you describe the emotional space, essentially, that is in you now when you think about that person? What's it like?
Pleasurable, anticipatory, tingly.
Cool. Yeah. In what way? Like that you would like to contact them again, or?
In the present. No.
No. What's it like right now in this moment? What's the present moment?
It's an evocation of a previous state.
Yes. And in the evoking, what's your emotional state like now? Like, are you excited about them? Are you in this current, like, present? You can remember the feeling of, like, tingly. Mm. But what's it like now?
It doesn't have a charge.
It doesn't have a charge. Yeah. How many folks would say that thinking about their first crush, in the present, the charge is gone? Yeah? Cool. You're all liberated. From that one attachment. Right? Angelic chimes. So, right, liberation consists in a way of the feeling of non-charge. You might still feel kind and compassionate and even warm and loving toward them. I totally, like, just bow to and respect this first person that I kind of got zingy-eyed about. Nothing in me needs to do anything with them any longer. Right? That urge, which is what we mean when we say charge. It doesn't mean like I don't like this person. It just means like the urge to, like, I must make contact somehow is gone. Right? And so the flavor of liberation is kind of a non-flavor. Or it's partly a non-flavor. It's the absence of that urge or charge. But it has a flavor, actually, right? How many would say that there was a kind of kindness or compassion or a sort of generosity of heart also toward this person? Yeah? Yeah, right? It's like, nice person, a nice suffering junior high person like all of us, right? Just as miserable as me. And so that turns out to be the flavor of liberation, is simultaneously this kind of the Buddhist tradition likes words like cessation or voidness or emptiness, but but you could just as easily say openness, right? If charge consists in contracting around something, it's openness, not in the sense of like blowing into a huge expansion, but actually a kind of balanced middle ground that's neither here nor there. Yeah? And then the qualities that I think are innate to non-neurotic relationship, which are kindness and compassion, warmth, non-grasping, friendliness, generosity. Those qualities, and of course these are the great virtues in the system, in most systems. These qualities are then easily accessible when there's not that charge or grasping. The hint toward that, please.
You can't even, I guess, look at refuge in the teachings I guess it, when I was thinking about it, that is one of the only places I do feel like I can find when I am practicing or sitting, or is in that moment at least. To think of it as only being refuge and liberation feels a bit depressing.
I'm so glad you're asking. Don't get depressed. You're doing great. No, this is the thing. We absolutely take refuge in the teachings and the archetypes of the teacher and the Sangha. In a way, what this is supposed to motivate you to do is saying, like, these are the true refuges, you know, Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, the teachings, the path. And because having the conditions for practice, like the Dharma exists in the world and you have a human body and you're not either, you know, like crushingly poor or like deluded privileged, but you're somewhere in the middle where you're actually suffering enough to want to practice, but not so much that you can't practice. Those conditions are considered precious and, like, you know, incredible. So therefore, like, go for it. You know, that you could be born in a time or place where there weren't... The thing about the teachings being impermanent is supposed to just make you cherish them. Because, you know, if I'd been born in really many other places, even within this country, these teachings wouldn't have been available to me. I'm so grateful that they were. So yeah, absolutely the teachings are a refuge. And then, you know, to say that they're also impermanent is just a way to say that, like, cherish them and practice them really vigorously since you have a chance to do so. So, any other questions or reflections here then? On any of this. Yeah.
I sometimes noticed in my practice when something really strong comes up, like a strong feeling, and then it goes away again. It's almost like this, like, shock of, like, what's next? Who am I? Like, when things just come up and are gone. It can be quite shocking sometimes, like the impermanence. And there's a sense of, like, of feeling of, like, a little bit like afraid or sad, like there's been a little unmoored.
What does the fear say? What's it afraid of or afraid will happen?
That's all it is, that there's nothing more, that the teachings are right, that nothing exists. But the reality of that, or the experience of things just coming and going very quickly, that's not abstract, it can feel very hard.
It is not abstract. It can feel very hard. The teachings are right, as far as I can tell. These particular teachings, at least in the flavor that I'm offering them, don't say that nothing exists, just to be clear, for folks maybe who are hearing that for the first time. They do say that nothing lasts. So if exists means, you know, has a permanent essence, then yeah. But... what you're speaking to is a very real part of practice. And the way through is just to keep practicing. To try to shut down the seeing of change in that way and the visceral response to it both doesn't really work, but also doesn't make one available for what comes next. And there is a what comes next. So this is a particular sort of phase in practice. And it can be a phase where taking refuge in whatever way you do can be really good. Like, you're like, okay, it's just like, you know, yeah, what to say? It's like, oh, this is the part of walking to New York where I'm walking across, you know, like the Nevada desert. And it's like, okay, it's going to be 50 miles of dry and hot. And but the only thing to do about that is just keep walking. So you just keep going and you take refuge again and again. And what you're seeing will always be true. Like, that will keep happening, but your relationship to it will change as you go on. So, All right. Yeah, sure.
I'm reminded of Octavia Butler's.
Always a good thing to be reminded of.
Yeah, so for folks who aren't familiar, there's a, I guess you could say, ideology within her work that essentially God is change. And so that the observation that the only thing constant is impermanence, essentially. Although that's not the language she uses.
Sure.
And I hadn't thought of it this way before, but there is a quality of, you know, they have a mantra, again, not the language they use, but like a chant, to remind themselves of the characters of her novels, remind themselves of this observation. And it strikes me now that there's actually in that kind of a quality of taking refuge in impermanence. The gift of that is like assistance with letting go.
Yeah. Yeah. No, she's a wise one, mm-hmm. Ms. Butler. There's a way that we could think of the whole path as that, as like assistance to letting go. You know? Because it's easy enough to say, and it's just not so easy to do, you know. So then we have all these structures that are themselves like ultimately inconsequential, but they're a scaffolding for being able to do this simple kind of profound thing of just letting go into the stream of change. So, yeah, thanks for bringing her into the room. Good. As part of bringing the chanting puja into the beginning of practice, we'll end with a chant as well. We've practiced doing this for a while now. And this is on the back side of your chant sheets, the last chants on the page. These are these are what are called the dedication of merit and the sending of blessings chants. And these chants both wish well to all beings, and they do this particular ancient maneuver of giving away the benefit of our practice. So we say like, oh, whatever good it came in this kind of energetic sense of my practice tonight, I offer it to beings in need, to others. And of course, the paradox to giving away merit is that giving away merit is one of the things that gains you the most merit. Like, it's a very good thing to do. So the more you give away, the more it piles up in your merit account. And the verse also includes, it's just a blessing verse. May the devas. The devas are the spirits, the earth and various realms, divine spirits. So again, I'll chant the Pali and then we'll speak the English together to end. Sambe sata sarahantu avera sukha jivino kataham punya palam mayam sabe bhagi bhavantute hotu sabang sumangalam rakantu sabha devata sabha buddhanubhavena soti hontu nirantaram Hotu sabang sumangalam rakantu sabadevata sabadhammanubhavena soti hontu nirantaram. Hotu sabang sumangalam rakantu sabadevata sabasanganubhavena soti hontu nirantaram. May all beings be happy, free from animosity. Whatever merit is the fruit of this practice, may it be shared by all beings. May there be every good blessing. May the devas protect you. By the power of the Buddhas, may you forever be well. May there be every good blessing. May the devas protect you. By the power of the Dhamma, may you forever be well. May there be every good blessing. May the devas protect you. By the power of the Sangha, may you forever be well. Thank you so much for being here. Blessings to everyone. Our circle is maintained fully within the practice of generosity. Your offering of your resources enables the studio to keep giving us the space and for me to come and teach and for us to keep the space available as a no one turned away space, which is so rare nowadays. So thank you for that and for your generosity in making that possible. You can give in the red box back there or at the desk in other forms. So thank you so much. There's a mailing list back there as well if you want to be on it and hear about stuff. Thank you. Have a good night.
Sean.
Yeah.